I just want to begin by saying that most of my remarks are, and the information that I'll share with you is from a relatively new book by Rosemary Radford Ruther, Gaia and God, where she brings in lots of different strands from ecology writing and feminist writings and her own theological Christian traditions, where she tries in this book to bring these strands and has us look at how where there is healing notions and healing possibilities instead of destructive possibilities in our own religious heritage, which has sometimes been criticized for being patriarchal and rather destructive and dominating the earth and women and all other powerless creatures and beings. So I would like to begin with just reading a little bit from this book as an introduction, and as I read some of the sections from the book, I would invite you again to comment and raise hands and continue the discussion as we did in our first session. Some of you started off by saying, I want definitions. That's exactly what we're going to get. The word ecology comes from the biological science of natural environmental communities. It examines how these natural communities function to sustain a healthy web of life and how they become disrupted, causing death to plant and animal life. And there is a kind of a natural order of sometimes there is an extinction of species as species move along and develop in their own ways and expand their populations and in the plant and animal world. And then decrease because of natural changes such as volcanoes and receding of lakes or dry periods. Desertification is one example. With the kind that happens without human intervention is what we're looking at here. The ecology in an expanded sense emerged in the last several decades to examine how human misuse of nature is causing pollution of soils, water, air, and the destruction of plant and animal communities, thereby threatening the base of life upon which the human species itself depends. Now, deep ecology, and this is the first good definition I found of this, has taken the study of ecology to another level. It's examining the symbolic and psychological and ethical patterns of destructive relations of humans with nature. It particularly sees Western culture, and this has been the most critical set of, I guess, critiques that they've brought to Christianity in particular as a major cause of this destructive culture. And I can give you a bibliography at the end of some of the reader or the authors that they have suggested in reading some of these texts. Karen, you've read some in this field too, so you are a resource. Deep ecology explores ways to create a new, more holistic consciousness and culture. They also, as these thoughts and strands developed, women writers who were feminists also, and I'll give the definition she gives of feminism, two different kinds. There's many dimensions, but succinctly, liberal feminism seeks equality of women with men in a democratic society. Then radical feminism declares that the issue is actually deeper, and that we have to look at patterns of culture and consciousness, the way we think even, that sustain male domination over and violence to women. And finally, ecofeminism brings together these two explorations of ecology and feminism in their full and deep forms and explores how male domination of women, and because males have mostly been in charge of societies, that the domination of nature and the use and misuse of our natural resources are interconnected because, in fact, here's a radical thought. I was thinking of calling one of my sessions sexual abuse of nature. Because I work with sexual abuse survivors and I do see that there is a pattern with some perpetration of these abuses over women and other powerless beings, as I said before. And that's what ecofeminists have put together. In this book, she talks about, and I'll get to the Gaia definition in a minute. Rosemary Radford Ruther has looked not only at the Christian and Judaic roots of our theology, but she's also a pretty good social scientist, too. So she looks at the cultural and social roots that have promoted destructive relations between men and women, between ruling and subjugated groups. And we're going to take a look at a couple of stories that she says are roots of some of these misdirected ways in our history. And she sees also a relationship between this destruction and the destruction of the rest of the biotic community. That means living, whatever is living, of which humans are an interdependent part. She, in this book, as I mentioned earlier, sifts through the legacy of our Judeo-Christian heritage to find usable ideas that might nourish a healed relationship to each other and to the earth. This is more, I think, in the deep ecology way of thinking, this next section. Any questions so far? Any comments? Any, like, is this real, new, or different? How many have read something on these topics before? I mean, a lot of this has been in some of our religious magazines. Anybody's read some of the deep ecology? Is this pretty new to a lot of you, then?
The vocabulary is, but not what we're doing.
Uh-huh. This feels like you know what this is about. We talked about it at lunch. So. She says that if dominating and destructive relations to the earth are interrelated with gender and class and racial domination, then a healed relationship to the earth cannot come about simply through technological fixes. And my husband and I debate this interminably, because he is a technologist and a scientist, where he wants to, you know, apply all of his technology to fix things. And I have seen that as a dangerous intervention in some of the natural processes of healing that the earth does for itself. But we continue to debate that anyway.
Do you have an example of that? So we can help understand that?
Well, just today, he was proposing that we mulch the bottom of the tailings piles, and that with a solid base of mulch on the bottom, there might build up a stronger root system at the bottom of the tailings, so there's not a lot of wash into the creek. Again, that's a and mulch it, and then plants at the bottom levels, on the bottom edges of the tailings piles. Because the theory is that there's some, at least acid complexes in the tailings that are eventually could change the acidic components in the plant life around Railroad Creek and then eventually Chelan Lake. And I saw that as kind of a quick fix that may in fact intervene in a different way than, and he was talking about bringing in plants from other regions of the country, and to me that's, no, I don't think that'll work.
I think some of those invasions.
Yeah,
that's, yeah.
And then you get another balance.
Go to Australia, you want to see how that works.
Yeah.
Do you think you ought to leave the wound exposed so people can see the abuse?
Well, it's quite a lesson for people that come here to think, what have we done? Steve is worried about some of the leakage from the tailings, even though in the information we have, it is not as serious as other sites where there is leakage. But there's still a concern. And he said, you reminded me today of the ecological saying, dilution is not the solution to pollution. You keep just washing it down and washing it down and washing it down with rain and into the lake, even though it's pretty diluted right now, eventually, you know, all those tailings will go into the lake, and that's not, I don't think Chelan would like that. She says, and this is where the deep ecology thinking, I think, has influenced her. She says, instead of the technological fixes, this thinking demands a social reordering to bring about just and loving interrelationships between men and women, between races and nations, between groups presently stratified into social classes. Sounds socialistic to me. Manifest in great disparities of access to the means of life. In short, it demands that we speak of eco-justice and not simply of domination of the earth, as though that happens unrelated to social domination. For her and for the deep ecologists, the eco-feminists, it is the same mentality that creates social inequalities as creates destruction and imbalance in our use of our resources. Does that make sense? Does that follow? Does anybody want to debate or comment on that? Do you want me to go on?
Can you elaborate a little bit more? You expressed an idea and I wasn't sure I was clear on what you were saying.
Okay. I think it might help. I'll read a paragraph here and I'll move. Oh, maybe I should ask what exactly or where in this process are you not seeing the connection?
You're saying that the person's, their background, their social status, or something that's relating to the environment?
Yeah.
I can give an example.
Okay, yeah, you've read some of this material.
I have an understanding of some of the material.
Yeah. There is a confusing sentence in here, too. Yeah.
Let's say cups, hot beverage cups. The cost of a paper hot beverage cup is more expensive to purchase with dollars than a styrofoam cup. So rationale became, we buy the most economical cup. So the cup that is chosen is the styrofoam cup, because that's the cash outlay. But the consequences of that is that we're not really paying the real cost, because there's a hidden cost, because that cup then, when it goes into a landfill or wherever, or the waste byproducts of it when it's manufactured, those costs are never being factored in. So the short, at least this is my sense of a lot of this, is that the short, narrow view of kind of using something and, quote, discarding it, or not looking at how it affects, you know, life further down, or in other areas where we don't see, it can be very exploiting or very abusive.
In the example of the styrofoam cups, chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, that are a byproduct of both the manufacture, and then if you burn it afterwards in a waste burning situation, that's the stuff that destroys the ozone layer, which is, if, as we destroy more and more of the ozone layer with our carbon emissions of those types, we are getting more and more skin cancers. And that's one of the effects. Eventually, it would mean the loss of life on this planet if we destroyed the whole ozone layer. So, I think what she was saying.
That's
that
very
answer?
Simple, yeah. That's
I'm trying to make something tangible.
I just couldn't see how social status or finance, or I just couldn't see.
Yeah. Well, I think sometimes the more social status we have, the more we're separated from the consequences of our purchases, because we simply purchase what we want, use it, and throw it away. And I think if you're closer to more of a subsistence living situation, each thing becomes pretty precious in that when I compare it with my grandparents' dairy farm, everything brought onto the farm either was brought in or raised on the farm, and any waste that people like here at Holden needed to be dealt with. And everything was used, basically. Now, whenever I go visit my grandmother and I go home, I'd even have trouble, or back to my husband in my apartment, when I'd have leftover grapefruit skins, it felt kind of, I always felt a little bit disappointed about having cows to go give those to.
Have to keep them in the apartment.
Yeah.
you read?
I always notice that separation when I'm here and on the garbo duty. And how many people go up there and go, oh, yuck, and it smells so bad, and I don't want to touch it. And, you know, thinking of it is a really obnoxious thing. And what it does to me is bring back my youth on the farm. I mean, it doesn't really smell bad. I mean, some of it, I don't want to live right up next to, but it's kind of the use that was made of everything. We did recycle what we had to in the best way that we could, and most of it went to the hogs. And I can come home from there, and, you know, I clean up my clothes, and it doesn't really smell bad to me.
It's earthy.
Yeah.
It's natural, organic disintegration.
It is.
It'll eventually happen to us, too.
It's less soupy, and, you know. But we are so far removed from that process now in our regular life.
We live pretty sanitized. Thinking, you know, how comfortable I am with dust, you know, from the hikes, kind of living with me for a day, you know. That's okay.
Talking about social status or social economic level and uses of resources came to mind when we had the water crisis, really. And then all these people say, well, I've got money, I can afford to use whatever I want to use, and I don't care. Mm-hmm. Other people can't afford the higher water rates, which are trying to discourage you from using more water, and it's sort of like, you know, it's okay for me because I can afford it.
Mm-hmm. As greedy as I want to be because I can pay for it.
Mm-hmm. And is that fair to everyone? Are we thinking about the disadvantage when we overuse our share?
In our situation when we were in the drought in California, it's true what you said to an extent too, but there were a lot more people pulling towards the same goal than I ever thought would even.
That they did conserve.
Yeah, they really did.
And there was a drop in the water level usage.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. But I still saw that attitude in a few people, not in a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And that connection, knowing that if you have the money or the privilege or a certain status in society, that the choices that you make can be life-threatening to the people that don't have that privilege. That, the water crisis, I think, may have brought that up.
Overusing water.
Mm-hmm. Overusing.
Yeah, the governor of the state was one.
Oh, not a privileged character.
No.
Gaia.
Yes. Yeah, I don't want to leave out a whole lot, but I do want to get to our two stories that I want to tell and then get to some of the more details. She explains that she juxtaposes the terms Gaia and God in the title of this book because all the issues that I wish to explore finally pose the question of the relationship. And by the way, the use of covenant in my title means relationship, essentially. Relationship between the living planet, Earth, and the concept of God as it has been shaped in our religious tradition. Gaia is the word for the Greek Earth goddess. It's also a term adopted by a group of planetary biologists, such as James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis. I also read of the Gaia concept in 1972 in a book Lewis Thomas wrote, Lives of the Cell.
Yes, yes.
And at the last page, he writes a poem to Earth as a living organism. And that's how they explain the term, is that biologists look at the Gaia concept as that the entire planet is a living system behaving as a unified organism, as you know, one body, everything interconnected, and that the ozone layer is the skin. And if our skin is broken, we're going to bleed, you know. But that poem, as you remember, is a beautiful poem, almost, you know, it reminds us how precious every cell of our earth and its skin is, and how beautiful. He wrote that after the astronauts took a picture of the whole earth from the moon. And there were a lot of poems and songs and photographs and paintings done from that kind of unusual experience.
It made people fall in love with the earth because we saw it from a distance.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful blue planet from space.
Right. Remember that song, Big Blue Marble? It was a kid's show, but I love that song. In this book, she assumes that the earth forms a living system of which humans are an inextricable part. We talked about this the other day, too, that we are latecomers to the earth, a very recent product of its evolutionary life. You know, even if you talk about geologic time, we are like a half a second, you know, of humans' existence in a whole 24-hour day. That is how long we've been on the earth, and in comparison to geological time since the beginning of this, this collection of dust that is our planet. Even though we are latecomers to the earth, we have constructed a concept of ourselves as humans over against all that is non-human, and thereby constructing our concept of nature as both the non-human and the non-divine. And she talks about more about how that that happens. Mm-hmm. And I'll get right to how she treats the two creation stories. These are kind of fun to look at. Has anyone taken a Bible study on looking at the creation story in Genesis and looking at, there's two different versions even in Genesis itself. Yeah. What I'm going to do is read what we're going to get to here is the social messages of different creation stories. And there was a story, in fact, written down in what they call extant. It was just rolling around in the Babylonian culture, in the place where the Hebrew peoples and the Judaic tribes were living. As you remember, there was a lot of conflict between the Hebrew tribes and those local people that had all these other weird ideas. And so the Hebrew story tries in some ways to differentiate themselves from the Babylonians, but she also sees that they were influenced in some ways. Some of the ways that there's some words in the Bible and there's some ideas that are connected to some of the Babylonian myths and traditions. Okay. Okay. Here we are. The Babylonian story is based on the Enuma Elish, and I'll just read the short story here, and then we'll get to some of the interpretations that she has given, which is, these are interpretations that I've never read before. So she puts a new light on some of these, looking at the social implications and, you know, like how we can see this, how it applies to some of the problems that we have right in our society today. So this is pretty exciting, this book that was just published 6 months ago or less. The Babylonian Creation Festival was read yearly on the fourth day of the New Year Festival to ensure the renewal of the cosmos. The epic in its Babylonian form, and I think we're talking about in the modern world, the part of the world which is Persia now, or Iran and Iraq now. In fact, the same place where our creation story is located, between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. That was old Babylonia. The epic in its Babylonian form was probably composed and put together in the early part of the second millennium BC, which is to me about 1800 BC. And the priestly collectors of the Hebrew creation stories put that together in the 5th or 6th century BC. In Babylonia, which was where they were in the Babylonian captivity under King Cyrus after they were kicked out of the Promised Land.
200 years.
Pardon, yes.
Here for 200 years.
Yes.
The Old Testament was written, but not by Moses.
This is a hard story to understand, and it's, her commentary is a little longer than the Hebrew story, but I would like to have you see the differences, so I'll read the whole thing. The Babylonian creation story was itself rooted in earlier stories from the Sumerian world. These stories begin with the primal mother, who is the origin of both the cosmos and the gods. The story is thus both cosmogonic, generating the cosmos, and theogonic, generating the deities. So the deities emerge in successive generations, somewhat like the Greek gods and goddesses, all those stories. And represents the successive stages of the generation of the cosmos. First, there emerges from, this is kind of a summary and then I'll get to the details, emerges from the body of that primal mother, who is Tiamat, her name. There are then the primal parents, heaven and earth. And then and they have names and personalities here as we go along. Then the primal cosmic forces, water, air, and vegetation. And then the gods and goddesses, the people that come and the that have other personalities, who in this culture represent, and this is an interpretation I've never heard before, represent the ruling classes of the city-states. Babylonian story also assumes an intergenerational struggle between older and younger deities. And she says it represents both the political conquests of younger states over older states and villages. And I think we have seen some of that kind of thinking, that hierarchical thinking and power-questing thinking in the Old Testament, in the warmongering that is a part of that strand of the Old Testament. It also suggests the struggle to harness and organize the machinery of political control and control of land and water against the chaotic social and natural forces that erupted periodically against this order. We see here there is some hierarchical thinking, or, you know, one up. There are some people that have more power, and then there's the slaves. And then there's the, you know, the use of the natural resources. The same as some of the implications in the Hebrew, in our own Judaic Christian tradition. So I think I'll just move ahead and read the story itself. The Enuma Elish was reworked from earlier creation stories, and it celebrates the ascendancy of the city of Babylonia and its deity Marduk, and that's more of the male god. And it celebrates that ascendancy over other cities. The ancient mother goddess Tiamat and her subordinate consorts Apsu and Kingu, and in this story they all live in kind of one body. It's male and female together, and they use for generation, you know, of new beings, they use the, in biology it's parthenogenesis. That means that instead of male cell and female cell uniting, or female beings and male cells uniting, it's a one-celled organism and it just pops off another being just like it. Is that?
Like an amoeba?
Like amoebas do. Yeah. Now we learn new words, the parthenogenesis. That's been used as an explanation of how Mary was parthenogenic.
No, I'm half of a daughter.
Well, oh, yes, genetically, yeah. Like a biologist here, too. well, okay. Apsu and Kingu, who are part of that same being, these are the representatives of the forces of chaos. Tiamat's consort, Apsu, is described as planning to kill those younger gods, those beings that they popped off, because their noise disturbs his peace. But Ea, their son, protects the younger gods by subduing the father image, Apsu. And that's a theme in a lot of, and John Bly talks about that, as in a lot of cultures where the son has to destroy the father in order to have his own personality.
It's true in the Greek.
Yeah. Ea rips off Apsu's crown and puts it on his own head and then kills him. And he assumes ascendancy over the cosmos and the other gods and establishes his religion. And then he and his wife Damkina have Marduk, the grandson. Well, Tiamat is the great mother now, prepares to intervene to avenge Apsu's, you know, her whole being, Apsu's death, and she fashions an army of monstrous beings. And by the way, Tiamat is actually the word for the sea. And it shows up in a couple of the other languages of that region too. Tehemos is a Hebrew word, and I think it means the ocean or water. And in Plato's Timaeus, is the origin of the creation. I think that refers to that original chaos. But in Babylonian languages, it refers to the sea. And, you know, women are often referred to as connected with water and the ocean and more, you know, fluid forces. She elevates Kingu, her other friend, as her new consort. The other gods are thrown into consternation, turning first to a god Anu and then the god Ea to protect them from Tiamat, because both of them feel she's pretty powerful. And primordially had been very powerful. They both fail to be able to face her. Finally, they turn to the young champion, Marduk, and Marduk meets Tiamat in a hand-to-hand combat, and warning, this is pretty violent. He catches her in a net, and he kills her with an arrow through her heart, and he extinguishes her life, and casts her down and treads upon her lifeless carcass, and he's kind of flattening her out. And Marduk then splits Tiamat's body in half like a shellfish, and that's real quite clear even in the writings that are preserved. He raises one half upward as the sky, and it seals off the water and the chaos above. Same, similar as in our Hebrew, some of the Hebrew phrases that are in our creation story. And then he fashions the stars and other planets of the heavens in the underside of her body. Now, at least that's what this version says. I had also heard a version where the underside of her body is the earth. But remember, it's dead stuff. So the Babylonian culture looks at the earth as kind of dead stuff, you know, already destroyed. And so therefore, their logic is that they can use it too. And she talks about, later on here, is that culture and the reason it is kind of dry in a lot of places in those regions. And the soil is very salty and acid is because there was from 3000 to 5000 BC a lot of irrigation going on to grow those crops, and all of those irrigation ditches were dug by all of those Babylonian slaves that were in service to those gods and those priestly rulers, and that kind of irrigation and the draining of those rivers created kind of dead soil. So there story was almost a reflection of what had been happening in real life. And she says also helped to promote the continuation of what they were doing, even though that some of the people might have thought that, well, this can't continue forever, it's going to turn into a, you know, more dead stuff. I think there were ecologists even in 4000 BC. All right. There are more stories about what then happens. Kingu fashions humans out of the blood and mixed with clay. There's some connection to our Hebrew tradition also. And the gods then impose servitude on these mortal creatures, the humans that were created out of the dirt. And he frees the gods for leisure, because all of these then lower slaves were created for the service to the gods. So she has us take a look at, I'm wondering if we should read our Hebrew story before we take a look at the comparing social messages. I'll read the other social messages that she puts here first, and then we can compare them. That in the Babylonian story, the gods arose out of an earlier, or primordial, which is first, forces, before the city-state and the order was established. And that it was matriarchal. And, summary here. That the model of generativity or creation is by parthenogenesis. That's maybe not the full spelling, but you get the idea. The new model that is created is kind of like a military power. In fact, it is. That's the model that destroys the primordial mother and takes power is a military cosmology, which is, it's not, she says, is not generative. It doesn't admire this kind of generativity or creativity, but it admires constructing things out of dead stuff. At least that's her interpretation. And it has the values of control and hierarchy. That it sets up as normative that there has to be higher beings and lower beings. So when we think about the contrast of a democratic society where ideally we all have the same rights to an equal share in our existence, this flies in the face of that kind of thinking. The last social message that she sees is that besides this class hierarchy, that the gods have their ease and humans' lot is just to work and provide service to the ones who are in power. And so there it set up that Babylonian city-state system pretty well. So they could enslave and have in power quite a number of workers by telling this story every New Year's Day. It reinforced the idea that that's the way it's supposed to be, folks. You know, and we were decreed this from the gods, from ages of old. Other writers, ecofeminist writers, have picked up on the idea and looked at a lot of anthropology in the last 15 years, and she refers to some of this in the middle part of the book, too. Picked up on there must have been some people that retained the memory of the original mother and the honoring of that original mother in that earlier culture somewhere. And anthropologists all over in the European and Turkish and Middle Eastern archaeology now are finding more evidence that there were more women honoring or what they call matriarchal type societies previous to 3000 BC.
That's a pretty common artifact, the shape of the female form.
Yeah, the theories have all been popularized, and in fact a lot of the pretty accurate archaeological information is contained in that series, The Clan of the Cave Bear. Mm-hmm. Have you ever written that, read that? Mm-hmm. I was surprised at the amount of research that she put into that, and that she does have quite a bit of knowledge. Of course, half of it is also fantasy.
Yes.
But she at least has some of the archaeological information at the beginnings of the books. I forgot the author. Jean Owl.
Jean Owl.
But let's move quickly. We have about 10 minutes left. Mm-hmm. We can go pretty quickly through the Hebrew story. That's pretty familiar to most of us. In the Hebrew story, the creator coexists with the primal stuff of the cosmos and is in serene control of the process.
Serene control?
Yeah, that's saying that let there be. You know, it's pretty much in control. There wasn't a whole lot of, you know, fighting between different forces and powers in order to establish the order
that
we have.
You know, it starts out by talking about chaos.
Uh-huh, that, yeah.
The created word has to work with that chaos. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's so serene.
No, but the way it came into being was serene. Just let it happen.
Serene. That we don't know. To switch chaos over into something that's organized, who knows what kind of a battle raged.
I know, but that's but we're talking not, about Genesis. We're talking about the story in Genesis.
The point that she sees in this interpretation is that, and the way she describes it, is that the Hebrew authors describe the shaping of the cosmos as proceeding majestically and orderly through 6 days of the Creator's work, and that it's a declarative power, that all that he has to say to create is to say, let there be. And that's pretty powerful use of just a word. But it's like it's a pretty powerful authority to use just a word, and chaos is extinguished or set back in some of the other creation stories. It, you know, it's into the outer darkness. What's the word in the Revised Standard Version?
What verse?
Oh, it's in verse, the first three verses. In the beginning.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness.
Light from the darkness.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night.
And the words for darkness have also been interpreted as including the chaos. Separating, the phrase later on, separating the waters. It's the same word, tehemu, okay, as in the Babylonian epic, Tiamat.
That there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. Mm-hmm. And let it separate the waters from the waters.
Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments on that particular part of the story? Yeah, biblical scholars can pick apart every word and have it have three or four different meanings. It's fascinating to me, but I want to get to the main point here. And although, you know, as we look at the details of these texts, yeah, three and four levels of meaning sometimes emerges. The Creator first creates light, separating from darkness. On the second day, he, like Marduk, creates the vault of the sky and separates the waters from those below. On the third day, the dry land emerges from the lower waters and the seed-bearing plants appear. On the fourth day, the Creator shapes the stars and the sun and the moon, and which governs night and day. And on the fifth day, he creates the fish and birds. And on the sixth day, he creates land animals, cattle, reptiles, and wild animals, followed by humans. Humans are distinguished from the animals by being made in the image of God. And they are given the rulership over all the animals of the earth, fish, birds, and land animals. All seed and fruit-bearing plants are given to humans for food, and green plants are given as food to wild animals. So we don't pay attention a lot of times to that differentiation. And that there was a vegetarian ethic, it seemed, in place when that was being written, and when as an original intent for our human living, an animal living with animals in a balanced way, as has been referred to back to Genesis, as hey, there's our model for that. And then we were clan of the cave bear, and they ate meat all the time. So I think our humans have gone through different phases and stages. At the completion of each day's work, the handicraft of the Creator is blessed by being pronounced good. And on the seventh day, the Creator rests, making holy this day as a day of rest. So she looks at the social messages of this story. I'm trying to make it a little more succinct than the three or four pages that she goes on. So, in the Hebrew story, God is not a warrior king, but a declarative authority power, just stating, let there be, and he was there at the beginning. There are male images, and hardly any female images of power, except when Eve comes along pretty late in the story. In fact, the female in Genesis 2 is created from the male, and some people, interpreters say, it just by the way the story is in this creation epic has been handed down influences us. It reverses that matriarchal memory, that memory of that somewhere there was a mother first, at least in this culture, which she says was influencing some of the thoughts of the people in this culture too. So this some theologians are saying that the reason this patriarchal theme came across so strongly in our Hebrew traditions in Genesis is that they were trying to differentiate themselves so severely from the Babylonian culture, especially when they saw that as polluting the one true religion here of the chosen people. So this then also implies patriarchal power. And by patriarchy, we mean that the male part of creation, including even all the names and pronouns for God and Adam as being the first and primary It implies that those male images, including God, are more powerful. And that's essentially been the critique of this, you know, our Judeo-Christian tradition, that, well, that's where the trouble started, you know. In the Hebrews wanting to differentiate themselves from this pagan religion, we implied patriarchal control, and therefore we even made a worse interpretation from the military structure and hierarchical control that was in the Babylonian culture. And we removed any honoring of a primordial mother completely.
Yeah. Where might some of that have gotten lost in translation, like the names for Adam and humus, and the fact that that was earth and clay and not male-female kind of stuff. I mean, the name Adam was not meant to be a man's name in the translation of
Adam. And in fact, that's the next thing I want to read. And that's what she says is one of the saving graces of our text. If we can recover it,
we said... That second Genesis story has a great deal of equality in it, and that's not the one we know.
The tell me again, the words for male and female in Hebrew are almost the same word.
Almost the same word, yeah.
Very close. And so there are some strands, as we were talking about the other day, there are strands in our Hebrew Judeo-Christian tradition that are saving graces, that are healing strands, if we can only uncover them and pick them out from the way it's been distorted and covered over and sometimes defensively created to contrast to another, or to survive in the midst of another culture.
Because our Bible even says God was making a human in our image, and from God's point of view, God was our.
Right.
That's
says...
That's still there.
Right. I do want to, you're about two steps ahead.
I'm just thinking about the language point of view.
Yeah, the language is, that's another area where if we really look in detail at the Hebrew that is used, there are, and we can see, the theologians in the last, 400 years have put layers and layers of meaning where maybe there wasn't meant to be that extra second layer of meaning, based on how our cultures have developed over the last two or three millennia. We've distorted some of the original messages. So, but she does want to honor that somewhere in those traditions in 3000 BC, there was a patriarchal thinking going on, and maybe in relationship to or somewhere in that culture, there was that strand also. In Genesis 1, it talks about the male being primary. But in Genesis 2, it talks about male being primary, created first. In Genesis 1, it talks about, as you said, you studied the male and female together. The last point that she makes. How many minutes do we have left?
About there.
Okay. I'm glad you introduced the closing. She states that one of the healing aspects that we have maybe not seen since we studied this is that division between, the higher ups, the rulers and the workers, or the gods and the servants in service to the gods, is eliminated. It's just not there. Even God both works and rests. He sets the pattern for sabbatica, on the seventh day you rest. And later on, 200 years late after this was written down, the judges and priests and kings declare a sabbatical system for the entire nation. Every 7 days there's the Sabbath. Every 7 years, there is a year off that the land shall rest, and all the workers of the land rest, and do other things, make baskets or whatever. And then, 7 times 7, after the 49th year, there's a year of Jubilee where everything stops. And, in fact, all the debts are erased, all the land goes back to its original owner. So she just says, this is the glory of all glories of one of the Judaic traditions that we should be paying a little more attention to. But I won't belabor that, but I will read you the closing. She also emphasizes, as Karen said, that humans were created in God's image, that Adama, who is the word, Hebrew word for earth, is a representative of divine rule, but is not given ownership of the creation. And that's a subtle but very powerful difference. These, you know, sub-beings, and in fact by definition then they're priests and rulers, have absolute rule over the rest of the humans and then the creation. We have that covenantal relationship, a sacramental and stewardship type of relationship that was handed to us as humans, but we don't own the earth, we are to take care of it. That's a subtle differentiation that we've missed out on also. I'm going to read this in closing some other alternative strands that Ruther saves for us. There. This obviously means that humans are to take good care of the earth, not to exploit or destroy it. That would make us bad stewards. The inclusion of domesticated animals in sabbatical rest, forbidding of many animals for human consumption, which occurs later in the texts, restrictions on the use of the flesh of those kinds of animals that humans can eat. This all limits our human rights to the lives of other earth beings. The word for human, Adama, earth, assumes a deep kinship of humans and earth. Humans also share a common warm blood with mammals, which is why, you know, in Jewish tradition, we are forbidden to eat the meat of these animals without first removing the blood. Other Hebrew texts also show a keen sense that human control over earth is limited. In storms and droughts and wild animals and wild places, the world of nature is manifest that is still directly under divine sovereignty and not given over to human stewardship. And there are many passages in the Old Testament. She talks, and I'll be talking a little bit more in my next session, about the words of God that came to Job. That a reminder that humans weren't even there when God was doing all sorts of other business. And we just don't understand what's going on, but there are principles and powers and forces and things that God is up to that we're really not to be a part of, and things that maybe we'll understand someday. But in the other session on wisdom literature, we looked at another creation story in Proverbs 8 that talked about that wisdom was there at the beginning of creation, and how she set up her seven pillars. And another interpretation that I give on this is that wisdom invites us to understand creation and really appreciate it, really understand the order and the structure, and that's why it's been so handy to have a biologist in my own house. I have come to understand the order and structure that is creation, and that, I'm hoping, is adding to our wisdom and our ability to take care of the earth in the best way. Any closing questions? And I know we're going to get to Vespers in 5 minutes.